Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today we hear from coffee growers in Kona about how research funding is vital to their future. We sit down with a geothermal expert from New Zealand. How can Hawaii harness its own energy potential? A new study into agroforests imagines a healing solution for our fallow land. What should we focus in on the year of our community forests? On today's Mano Minute, we hear the song of a finch found only in the northwestern Hawaiian islands. Plus, we meet an artist who draws from her background in Canada and Germany. She's part of the Hawaii Triennial Festival happening across the islands, and she invites you to come feel the art. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Got coffee? Well, it's what many of us can't do without first thing in the morning. Prices are in record territory, partly due to lower global yields. But what's the snapshot locally? Here to talk about that is HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Have you had your coffee?
I have, yes. And I actually got to attend the Kona Coffee Farmers Association Symposium in Kona yesterday, which is a dream assignment for a coffee lover such as myself. And coffee is just so deeply woven into the history and the culture of that area. But the industry is at this real inflection point. There are a lot of challenges that they've encountered in the last couple of years that they're continuing to grapple with. Here's how Suzanne Schreiner, who's been farming coffee for 20 years in that area, described it.
We are facing an existential moment, and I'm not sure we can properly document in this moment what Kona's going to look like in 10 years because there's so much change happening within our crop and within the larger world. But we have to save it. It's really important.
Yeah, so what kinds of things are we up against?
So there are some things like exchange rates. For instance, the dollar is stronger than other currencies in some areas, specifically a strong market for Kona coffee, Japan. That's lowering costs or lowering sales of Kona coffee. Labor costs are on the rise. But the real double whammy that we've seen in Kona has been the coffee berry borer beetle. Try to say that three times fast, and coffee leaf rust. So the berry borer beetle, when it was introduced in 2010, Hawaii was just one of a handful of growing regions that didn't yet have it. And it literally devours beans from the inside out and has caused hundreds of millions of dollars in damages to the worldwide coffee industry every year. And so after a decade of trying to get a handle on this berry borer beetle, Kona got hit with another introduction. That's the fungal disease coffee leaf rust, which attacks the leaves of coffee trees and interrupts their ability to photosynthesize. And Schreiner said that when this happened, it was just devastating.
Coffee leaf rust showed up in 2020 at the height of the pandemic, and it was one of those, are you kidding me moments? I can't believe this is showing up now. It was our worst case scenario. The year after CLR showed up, we had probably about a 50% drop in yields across the Kona district. It was truly tragic. Some growers lost 80% of their crop, and it's been a struggle to get back to even. Last year, we got it back up to a little closer to normal, but I think this year is going to be another bad year. We had a bad winter with CLR, and we're going to pay for it.
Wow, 80% of someone's crop? Yikes.
That's the landscape for Kona coffee now. It's hard and it's expensive. So between those two introduced species, the fungal disease and the pest, people are spraying treatments on their farms. And if you have both, you may be spraying 10 times a year or more to try to keep them under control. And now, on top of that, due to the actions of the Trump administration, there's uncertainty around federal funding into research for solutions to coffee blight like coffee leaf rust. So Suzanne Schreiner wears another hat. She's also the administrator for the Hawaii Synergistic Agriculture Council, which formed to support different specialty crops, coffee, also macadamia nuts, floriculture, and papaya. And they had received a multi-year $6 million grant from the USDA to investigate solutions to coffee leaf rust. But a few weeks ago, the remaining $2.8 million of that grant was frozen without explanation. It's since been unfrozen because of a court order, but that expires on March 14th, and Schreiner says she doesn't know what the permanent status of that grant will be after that. And it's not just the research itself that's on the chopping block. The people behind the research have been fired. So several members of the Hilo office of the USDA's Agricultural Research Service have lost jobs as a result of President Trump and Elon Musk's efforts to shrink the federal workforce. So I spoke to a member of the Hilo ARS office who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they had not been authorized to speak publicly on the subject, and they confirmed that 6 people in their office in Hilo had lost positions. Additionally, an entomologist and a geneticist had been fired, but those positions were actually reinstated over the weekend. So there's a lot of uncertainty broiling around whether or not people will be able to continue their research, whether or not they have jobs, what will move forward with these grant fundings. And a separate way that the Kona coffee industry is being affected by the recent actions of the Trump administration that might surprise listeners is Trump's bid to gut USAID is impacting coffee research. So Schreiner says the Agricultural Council was part of a $500,000 USAID grant looking into soil fertility in Hawaii and Guatemala, as well as another $6 million grant program that was also looking into how we can develop trees that are more resistant to coffee leaf rust. And she expects that those grants are now as good as dead, though she's working with congressional representatives to see if that money can be transferred from USAID into the Federal Department of Ag. So I spoke with Representative Jill Takuda. Kona is in her district, and she sits on the Congressional Committee for Agriculture, and she says she's been paying very close attention to this issue.
USAID, everyone thinks that it's just about, you know, sending money outside of the country. But people don't realize that for the last 30 years, USAID has also been extensively supporting coffee research. We're talking tens of millions of dollars over the last 30 years. You cut USAID, you eliminate them, you eliminate that money that's gone to research.
Yeah, we've been hearing that, right, that it's not just foreign countries, it's, you know, places in the States. So, yeah, the impact is it just ripples.
Yeah, for our research purposes, and this was something that I didn't know until I was looking into it, when we invest dollars internationally for research, that has to have some sort of domestic benefit. So Kona Coffee has been able to get in on a lot of these research grants saying, hey, if you're looking into ways to address coffee blight internationally, that could help us here at home. So that's why we have had a part in many of these grants. So Jill Takuda is trying to create a forum in order to discuss these issues. In addition to her work on the Agricultural Committee, she's actually launching the Coffee Caucus. So this is a bipartisan effort that got underway towards the end of last year.
Well, you know, when we started the caucus, we had no idea that we would be in this situation, to be very blunt with you. Now, flashing forward to today, I believe this caucus is even more critical because the impacts of the recent funding freezes and the EOs, it's going to hurt our coffee growers. It's going to hurt the industry. We can talk about how, in order to sustain this coffee industry, it is about looking at research and how it has health benefits, right? So how can we start those conversations, perhaps move some bills, perhaps in this case, unfreeze funding that is absolutely important for our growers to be able to benefit from science. You know, this is just one of many opportunities. But I think for me, any chance that we have to sit at bipartisan tables together and work on things that are, you know, mutually important, we have to take advantage of every one of those opportunities and to some extent even lean in. Or we've really got to lean into that opportunity to be bipartisan for things that our constituents and our communities really care about.
Yeah, and we care about coffee.
We certainly do. There was one recent success for Kona coffee farmers, and that came out of last year's legislative session. And that was a bill to make sure that things that are labeled as Kona coffee have to be 51% Kona coffee or more. So folks were excited about that at the symposium, something that lawmakers are tackling this year, and there are measures alive in the Senate and the House, is what enforcement mechanisms are in place if you don't abide by that labeling. So that's something lawmakers are having a conversation about this session.
Yeah, but lots of pressures, right, between pests and disease and the price of coffee and funding.
Absolutely.
But thanks so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. She was reporting on the economics of the Kona coffee industry. Check out her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Onihoa, olehua, onihau, okaua, oahu, omolokai, olanai, omaui, okaholabe, ohawaii.
For today's backyard quiz, we are talking about the feeling we all know too well, regret. In this case, it's the regret of a man named Wally Conron. For decades, he was well known as a dog breeder from Australia. A visually impaired woman here in Hawaii had a special request for Conron in 1989. She needed a service dog in her life, but her husband was allergic to long-haired dogs. She wanted a non-shedding dog breed that her husband could live with. So Conron came up with the perfect solution. At least he thought so at the time, but more than three decades later, he said, "I opened a Pandora's box and released a Frankenstein monster." He said the breed he created for the Hawaii resident was often crazy, but that hadn't stopped dog lovers from spreading his invention across the globe. It's become one of the most popular mixed breeds in the world. So what is the breed of dog that Conron unleashed? Think you know the answer? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for young farmers seeking a future in agriculture, such as the Waianae Community Redevelopment Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
This morning, Kilauea Volcano displayed a fountain of dazzling power on the Big Island. Today, we bring you a voice for geothermal energy development. Gavin Murphy is a geothermal consultant working in New Zealand, which generates 20% of its energy needs through natural resources. He dropped by our studio to talk about what we can learn from New Zealand's journey harnessing this untapped power.
Well, I guess New Zealand, Aotearoa, has had a long history of geothermal development going back to the late 1950s, early 1960s, and characterized, I guess, by probably three phases. The first being largely in the early days state-led, so the government took the lead on very early exploration and sort of engineering development of geothermal when it was a relatively new science in engineering in terms of power development. And the benefits of that were that early on our country did quite a lot of geological mapping of the different potential reservoirs and did a lot of drilling in the early days, and the government doing that work meant that later in the next phases, as investors came on board and geothermal technology developed such that it was efficient and effective power systems, it meant they could work off the back of that base work and take investment decisions and risk and build geothermals, so that it's now around about 20% of our total national grid generation is just under 20% is geothermal baseload in New Zealand. And I think there's something over 20 separate power stations generating into the grid. And that helps us. In our country, the grid runs between, depending on hydrological conditions and other things, with geothermal as a key baseload, it runs between sort of 85 and 95% renewable on an annual basis. And I guess that early government exploration, support funding, science and taking some of that risk, as we deregulated the electricity industry in New Zealand in the 1990s, it allowed the privatisation and investment sector to get involved in geothermal development, which was led to that level of geothermal generation in our country.
We are looking to help ourselves become more resilient.
Yes.
And we're trying to figure out what is the best path forward. But because you've had this early experience and you've gone through the trial and error and you've made mistakes, what have you told our stakeholders here about you know, the possible pitfalls, what to be careful about.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're having meetings this week, so that conversation's sort of ongoing. But I think from our perspective, the pitfalls and things, so those early phases were probably characterised by not taking the community, the landowners and mana whenua, the indigenous Māori people of New Zealand, on that journey in an equitable way. I believe that's being done now, and that's where we certainly learned some things from working with IDG here in Hawaii back in New Zealand. So I think the pitfalls, making sure that the geothermal development projects are respectful and equitable for landowners, and that there are community outcomes as part of, as well as a reliable and efficient grid and a renewable grid, that the landowners and the community around the geothermal power stations are part of the conversation and are part of the development. I think we're getting better at doing that in New Zealand. Still a ways to go, but a lot better. I think very early on we learnt reservoir management is really critical. So making sure that you sustainably develop and respect the geothermal reservoir in terms of reinjecting, managing the reservoir chemistry. We learned some hard lessons in the 1980s, probably, and I think we do that particularly well now. And then I think largely after that, it's through the diverse number of reservoirs we've got, the country's got a portfolio approach to generation. So we've got developments on more than one reservoir, and no one development on the reservoir is too big for that reservoir. So we're commending those approaches to the stakeholders in this country. Take your community with you. Take a sort of a portfolio approach to the development. Make sure you don't put all your eggs in one basket in terms of a reservoir or in one development on that reservoir, and make sure you respect the science and the reservoir itself. Start with that, and the engineering and economics will follow.
So right-size it from the get-go.
Right from the get-go. And ensure that you're adaptive. So as you develop and you have drilling and you have reinjection, that continual science monitoring the reservoir, making sure before you go to the next stage that you check in, you adapt, you review. And so the reservoir science evolves along with the use of the development.
So how do you get past maybe people's fears about this untapped energy and the smells, you know, because people worry about living next to this power?
Yeah, and it's understandable, and it is something that is, you know, taking the community with you means the conversation about those kind of things. And I think it's just a question of being transparent, talking to the community at every stage of the development of what you're thinking and why. I mean, I would commend the opportunity for stakeholders to come and visit Aotearoa New Zealand and see how there are geothermal power station developments in communities, how we are managing, ensuring the reservoirs are sustainable intergenerationally. Importantly, how we've developed, and probably in the last 20 years, a much more equitable model where landowners and communities can benefit from the downstream uses of geothermal around direct heat use, whether it's for other economies or heating systems. And then I guess you just have to work through the science, show the community the science, and have the discussion and debate about what it's telling you around geothermal reservoirs, gases. And I guess seeing is believing. You know, there's over 20 developments in Aotearoa, and as far as I'm aware, there's been no health concerns or issues as a result of those sitting side by side in communities around the sort of upper North Island.
And, you know, there are some proposals at the legislature and how that might fit in with the Hawaiian homelands, homestead land, that kind of thing. Anything about Hawaii and its uniqueness that maybe you don't have with geothermal over there in New Zealand?
Probably a couple of things spring to mind. One is each geothermal system is a bit unique. So the geochemistry and makeup of the fields in Hawaii and the gases and the chemistry will be a little bit different to ours. And so,
better,
know,
worse? I don't know.
I don't think better or worse. Certainly a lot hotter. So from a geothermal use energy engineering perspective, they certainly look like they're very good resources for use. But different chemistry, so different issues to manage around emissions. I think probably the other big difference is the heavy reliance on fossil fuels here at the moment and the integrated generation, grid, distribution and retail model of your energy sector. So ours is very much a deregulated market economy, which allows independent power producers to develop their investments, and then they're able to build them and connect to the grid and understand the grid connection costs and the market opportunity for power sales. Here, the challenge, I think, is understanding how an independent power producer of geothermal fits into the grid system. That conversation with policymakers, regulators, and HECO and HELCO is vital in order to get investment confidence to develop here. But then I see some parallels as well. So, you know, you mentioned DHHL in New Zealand, a lot of the geothermal resource sits on multiply owned Māori land, so indigenous land owned by iwi, by families, by tribes. And so the New Zealand model of how you work through that and that conversation with those landowners, some strong parallels to bring here to the islands, I think.
What about innovation? Because we hear lots about how they're doing things, you know, with hydrogen and water and turning that into jet fuel. And so, I don't know, are you using AI at all in any of your applications as you develop geothermal?
Yeah, I think there's small amounts of AI being used in the engineering around the geothermal power plants. I think where the innovation's probably more occurring for us is twofold. It's probably in the downstream uses. So I think for Hawaii, you've got to walk before you can run. And what I mean by that is just get the basics of some geothermal power stations into the system and replacing your fossil fuels, providing an indigenous, resilient, local fuel source for your electricity energy. And those are the foundations. What we've been developing in Aotearoa in the last 15, 20 years is downstream uses for things like drying milk powders, drying timber, although that's been around for quite a while, hothouses for flowers, and more recently, the one you touched on, hydrogen. So we've now got small pilot scale hydrogen plants built off the back of geothermal, where they're using geothermal when the price for electricity in the middle of the night is very low in our country. They're using that energy rather than going to the electricity grid to create green hydrogen, which they're now trialling to put into vehicles and transportation. And I think that's a big future for New Zealand is hydrogen byproducts of geothermal at the right times, clean hydrogen.
Did New Zealand have any difficulty in getting financing, getting investors interested in developing this new technology?
No, not particularly. The range of investment models in New Zealand, but the predominant one is with the deregulation of the electricity sector. A lot of the government energy, national energy company got split up and they sort of moved to a 50% government, 50% private investment model for a number of them. And that's attracted quite a lot of private investment co-owned with the government, sort of a PPP type style. And that investment model's been solid at really developing geothermal generation, along with others such as wind and hydro and solar. But wind particularly. Then there are private companies, which is the organisation I used to work for, that have privately developed separately. And if the early exploration risk is managed by the investors, then debt funding and bankers and financing is really available for good projects.
Any downside to developing geothermal in your mind?
Geothermal advocate, so not heaps. But I think not the issue with geothermal, but the things you need to manage carefully with geothermal is obviously you have to go where the reservoir is. So you can't, unlike some sources of power, you can perhaps locate them where the customer is. Geothermal's challenge is you have to build it where the geothermal reservoir is, and that's not always where the demand for electricity or hydrogen is. So that's one challenge. So you have to build where the reservoir is and transport your energy to where the
transmission
customer,
lines.
Transmission lines being typical. And then the other one is it's underground. It takes quite a lot of science. So the early phases of exploration do come with significant risk and uncertainty. And so the carefully managed science-informed stepped program you have to work through in the early years, it's quite high cost and quite high uncertainty until you get to the point where you've been able to explore through drilling the reservoir. So not so much downside, but the early exploration costs and risks weigh heavily before you get to a certain investment. So that's the tricky bit with geothermal, I guess, that early development.
I guess based on what you've seen in New Zealand and where Hawaii's at, we have lots to be hopeful.
Look, I believe so. We're both island countries, both strong indigenous people, and in many cases, the land, the whenua, as we would say, where the resource is owned by indigenous landowners. The community's highly invested in the outcomes in both countries. And I guess that early exploration involvement by the government, the state as it would be here, certainly helped de-risk it in the early years in Aotearoa. So I think there's lots of parallels. I mean, in US mainland, there's significant geothermal. I think by country, the US mainland's got the most geothermal development in the world. So strong sort of background of geothermal on the mainland US to lean on too as appropriate.
Any other final thoughts?
Oh, no, I think it's a huge opportunity. My independent observations, I guess, is, you know, just the level of fossil fuels and imported oils used to power the electricity grid here, both to my mind, looks very expensive from an economic perspective. And I certainly admire the 2045 Clean Energy Initiative, and I just commend the country and the stakeholders for having that initiative, and certainly going to have to work hard to achieve that. And I think geothermal can play a big, big part in a firm baseload, you know, indigenous power source.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This has been very educational for all of us.
Mahalo for having me.
And that was Gavin Murphy, a geothermal consultant from New Zealand. He met with University of Hawaii officials yesterday and plans to connect with state lawmakers on his visit here. The Department of Business and Economic Development and Tourism is on his list today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Moku'o ke awe. Join Hawaii Public Radio at Kahilu Theater on Friday, March 21st for a live taping of The Conversation and Kanikabila Sunday. We talk story with author and longtime Parker Ranch veterinarian Billy Bergen, UH biology professor Patrick Hart of Manu Minute, and Hilo singer-songwriter Kainani Kahaunaele. For more information, visit hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Big Island Coffee Roasters and Merriman's Restaurants.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering master programs in finance, information systems, marketing, and travel industry management. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
Agroforests incorporate trees and shrubs into food production, and a new study finds yet another reason to invest in them locally: carbon storage. A team of Hawaii researchers mapped unmanaged fallow agricultural land across the state, and they found that if all the land were converted into agroforests, it would counteract the carbon emissions of 100 million barrels of oil. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with two of the researchers, Leah Bremer and Kavika Winter. Bremer starts us off.
What does it mean if we think about agroforestry scaled up, for a lack of better words, particularly on fallow agricultural lands? So we know that about 40% of our agricultural lands are fallow or unmanaged. As we've seen in the recent fires, pose high fire risk, also do not provide a lot of value. So we wanted to look at the benefits of scaling up the restoration. So our overall project was much more broad, right? We're looking at lots of different benefits of agroforestry, but our focus on carbon for this paper is kind of multiple reasons. One, climate change, right? But then also related to that, so Hawaii has committed to carbon neutrality by 2045, right? And of course, the biggest part of that is reducing fossil fuel use, but we can't get to neutrality if we don't also think about the role of land care and management in helping to reach that goal. And then at the same time, you know, nobody does restoration for carbon. It's not like somebody wakes up in the morning and says, I really want to sequester more carbon today, and that's what gets me out of bed. But carbon ecologically, it is what trees are, plants are made of, right? Half of the biomass of a tree is carbon. And then soil carbon is the organic matter, the life of the soil. So it's really important to think about.
Speaking as somebody who wakes up in the morning thinking about how I'm going to sequester more carbon. Well, so when you ask this question, I think, wow, there are so many streams of interest that are pulled together in this paper, and it's hard to really talk about one of them. And I think the ultimate origins of this paper, at least for me, is this bigger question. How is the human civilization going to survive on this planet in the future? How are we going to feed 9 billion people or however many people on the planet right now? How are we going to keep having a stable climate while providing our energy? How are we going to do this? How are we going to do that? And the answer to a lot of these questions are to look back at indigenous knowledge, because there have been indigenous formed eco-civilizations on this planet that figured out how to support high populations while keeping forests, while feeding their people, while keeping the integrity of the oceans and all of these things. And so it just so turns out that we're living in this beautiful place of Hawaii that was once home to one of those amazing eco-civilizations. So there was, at that time, there were zero food imports. So we were feeding more than a million people in these islands without importing food. We were able to do that while maintaining our forests. And so this is the one of the things that I think about. Really, what's going to make it or break it for humanity is figuring out how to maintain the forests of the planet.
Leah, tell me a little bit about this modeling work, because it's rare that you find a study that both looks back in the past and then projects to the future, and also projects to the future in a way that isn't all doom and gloom, to say, well, what if instead of getting it wrong, we got it right in terms of converting this fallow agricultural land into agroforests? So what do those results show?
A lot of us were super inspired by some of the work Natalie Kirishima did for her PhD, right? Doing modeling of historical indigenous agricultural systems, right? And that's just one effort. There's also newer work as well that looks at other systems. But anyway, we started with Natalie's colluvial agroforestry or sloped agroforestry layer of this is where there might have been this type of agroforestry. And then we decided that we would also expand it to flat areas that were zoned agriculture, but not being used, right? So not being used for any kinds of crop, not being used for pasture. They're just sitting there. And as we know, kind of becoming more and more of a fire risk in some areas, harboring invasive species. But then with that, we came up with a map of, okay, here's where you could do agroforestry, where it could make sense today. And of course, there's lots of other things that need to happen for that, right? Like financial resources and land tenure and all kinds of things. But you know, if those were removed, here's where it's biophysically and zoning possible. We also did include areas that are zoned conservation, but are all non-native forest, right? And the areas that overlapped with Natalie's original modeling. So what we came up with was about 370,000 acres of land that you could potentially transition to these, what we're calling these multi-strata agroforestry systems, which, you know, there's a lot of different iterations of that. Many are OEV led. That's about half of the unmanaged agricultural land, right? So that's a big part of land. It's about 10% of the state. And then we also found about 25,000 acres of that non-native dominated conservation lands. We then looked at, okay, how much carbon in the vegetation could these systems sequester? And we find the number between 90 and 125 metric tons of carbon per hectare. So that's a number that probably doesn't mean a whole lot to too many people, but it's, you know, about the same as native forest. So we're not in any way suggesting to do agroforestry instead of native forest. It's just, it's a hybrid restoration system that has a history here and is culturally relevant here that makes a lot of sense on many parts of Hawaii. And then the last piece is we wanted to include soil carbon, right? Because that's a huge part of the carbon story, but often left out in some of these carbon offset projects because it's hard to figure out what happens to soil carbon. And what we find is there's the most evidence for an increase in soil carbon if you're transitioning areas that were used for intensive cultivation. So it's the areas that were in pineapple and sugar plantations that we actually have the most potential to increase soil carbon and above ground carbon at the same time. If there's people who want to fund community-based, place-based, OEV-led agroforestry, and they want also to support carbon, those areas are kind of your hotspots.
What should a listener know about this study? Kavika, you can start.
When it comes to issues like global climate change or any of these really big issues that seem almost too big to solve, you know, our human brains haven't been evolved to solve problems this big. So there's a natural human tendency to just not think about it because you can't even think about a way to solve it. It's too big, it's too complex. But here is something that a lot of us in Hawaii could support in various ways. We can support, you know, within our communities, whether it's within our ahupua'a or within our larger moku, we can be supporting these efforts to restore agroforestry so that at the community level, we're thinking about carbon sequestration. We're tangibly solving this problem in an everyday way that really isn't that hard at the end of the day. So, you know, when we think about, you know, just Yeah, okay, I'm a weirdo. So I think about, okay, I'm getting on a flight to DC next month. I need to plant a tree somewhere. You know, there's going to be a lot of people, you know, increasingly, especially the younger generations, are starting to think like this. Okay, I'm getting on a flight to LA. I need to go plant a tree. Where could I do that? There need to be places within our communities. It doesn't need to be this faraway thing. We're supporting some effort in the Amazon rainforest. It should be. We're supporting something in our own agua. And I think we're getting closer to a place where something like that is going to be a reality.
The message I would want people to take from this work is that as a state, we need to figure out how to transition these lands, right? There's no option. We can't just keep 20% of the state in non-native grasses and non-native shrublands that pose huge fire risk and don't produce food on land that's zoned agriculture, right? We have different options of how to transition them. Agroforestry is one of them. And the more we can recognize the benefits that those stewards provide to all of us and translate our recognition of those benefits into support for the people that are taking care of these lands, I think that's where we can get to a much, you know, more sustainable and resilient society. So I think carbon is one lens of that, but there's lots of other ways that the work that folks in Malo'ivi and other groups do, how that benefits all of us.
That was Leah Bremer and Kavika Winter talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have links to their research on the conversation page of our website later today. On today's Mono Minute, we have the song of the Nihoa finch, which are endemic to Nihoa Island in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands and are found nowhere else in the world. These recordings are courtesy of Zeno Canto. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
The Nihoa finch is a ground-nesting Hawaiian honeycreeper that's found only on tiny Nihoa Island in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands and nowhere else in the world. They're a bit smaller than their close relatives, the Laysan finch, but otherwise look similar, with the males mostly bright yellow and the females duller, with dark brown streaks on their head, breast, and back. Both sexes have big, sturdy seed-eater bills that they use to eat a huge variety of foods, including fruits, seeds, leaves, flowers, insects, and even bird eggs and carrion. If you're lucky enough to ever visit Nihoa Island, you can't miss their lively, canary-like song. Nihoa finch were recently given the Hawaiian name Palihoa, as their original name seems to have been lost. While their population seems relatively stable at about 3,000 birds, they're listed as an endangered species because they're vulnerable to catastrophic events, such as hurricanes. To lower the risk of losing them this way, they were introduced decades ago to Tern Island, further to the northwest, but that population went extinct by the early 1980s. Fossil evidence shows they were once also found on other Hawaiian islands, including Molokai and Maui, but tiny Nihoa is the only place they've managed to hang on, likely due to the lack of predators and mosquito-borne disease. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, exploring Hawaii Island with visitors and kama'aina for more than 30 years. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
President Trump's lawsuit against media outlets are sending a message to both sides.
To both the Trump team that they can aggressively pursue these lawsuits and to others in the media that maybe they are going to have to settle or that they're going to have to not be able to fight these cases.
I'm Deborah Becker. Lawsuits, free speech, and the changing media landscape. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
Now it's time to embark on the answer to today's backyard quiz. For today's quiz, we asked you about a popular mixed breed dog that got its start here in Hawaii. The breed later became a lifelong regret for the man who invented it. While Lee Conran was trying to come up with a service dog for a visually impaired woman who lived here in Hawaii, and her husband was allergic to most breeds. So Conran decided to crossbreed a poodle with a Labrador retriever, and he named it Sultan. Take a listen to this 2019 clip from ABC News for today's answer.
The creator of the Labradoodle says he regrets it. Wally Conran of Australia crossbred the first Labrador poodle in 1989. He worries he, quote, opened a Pandora's box and released a Frankenstein, in his words, believing most Labradoodles and other designer breeds are at greater risk of medical issues and anxiety.
So Conran created the Labradoodle. That was the answer we were looking for. Lots of callers today, but McKenna from Kaneohe had the fastest fingers. That's our quiz for today. If you have an idea for one to share, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Underway now is the Hawaii Triennial 2025, and one of the featured guest artists led a delegation of artists from Canada last year to the prestigious 60th International Venice Art Biennale. Kapuana Kiwanga has won numerous art awards across Europe. She has spent the last month working with Hawaii artists for the triennial. She's also this year's Distinguished Chair in Democratic Ideals at the University of Hawaii and will give a free talk tomorrow night at the Art Auditorium. We got a chance to talk to her about her work this morning.
Well, being part of the triennial has been really lovely because it's been a way to meet other artists as well, see their practice at the Bishops where I'm showing a museum where I'm showing one of my installations. I'm in conversation with other artists there. So I discovered their work and it's all really quite pertinent. And that's been really lovely. As you're installing the work, you get to talk to people and get to know them a little bit as well, informally. But then also local artists. So of course, from this island, but other islands as well. And so that was really nice. And also just the different perspectives that you get because sometimes place and culture are going to influence somewhat differently what one wants to make, the stories one wants to tell. And so to be able to meet other artists who were coming from this region or even just more Asia-focused was a nice change, refreshing for me from just a Eurocentric kind of conversation.
So share with our listeners what your art piece looks like, what they can experience when they go to a Bishop Museum. I mean, I understand it's a fiber piece.
Mm-hmm. It's maybe not fiber and what I would think of like a tapestry or anything like this. So it's as soon as you walk into the main exhibition space that's dedicated to the triennial at Bishop's, it's a very dark space. It's pretty much black and the lighting is quite dim. You'll kind of see a point that kind of comes out to you, and it's a point that then extends into the space. So it's kind of a triangle or maybe looks like a boat helm, and it's covered with this soft looking fuzzy material, and that material is called sisal. It's kind of a golden, light golden white, and it's draped in kind of these layers. And as you walk around the installation or the sculpture, which is quite large, you can actually enter into it. So it extends out as though it was a triangle. And then it kind of becomes a rounded space at the back. So it's really an architectural kind of proposition. There's three entranceways in which one can come into that space. And then you'll be surrounded completely by the sisal. So you're in a sisal environment. And it kind of glows in the space because the fiber is so luminescent with the lighting and I think the contrast with the dark environment. Some people say that there are, I guess, visual semblances with some of the architecture from this place, but the material is very different. It's sisal. It's not using the grass or any particular material that's from here. Sisal originally comes from southern Yucatan in Mexico, but has been cultivated for centuries now in different parts of the world. The biggest exporter is Brazil, and then after that you have Eastern Africa and other places. So it's not from here, but there's some maybe semblances, or it evokes maybe some of the grasses that might have been used in architecture or cultural making here.
And what's the name of this installation?
The name of the installation is Vestibule. So it's kind of, it is, and it does very much have that function of kind of welcoming or being the first entrance point before, I guess, entering into the rest of the exhibition of some sorts. Mm-hmm.
And I've looked at some of your work online, and I was intrigued because you talk about some of the material that you use, and you talk about them as commodities and how cultures kind of intersect. You know, things were traded back in the early days. Mm-hmm. And, you know, someone said, well, you have what I want. You have what I need. I just love that idea. I mean, you had, I was looking at the one installation where you had tiny glass beads from Italy.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So the installation that you're describing is from the Venice Biennial, the last Venice Biennial where I represented Canada. In that case, it was very much exactly what you're describing, trying to understand the relationship between these tiny glass beads, which were made in Murano, just a little island outside of Venice, and traded all over the world for different raw materials. So those could be precious metals, ivory, and unfortunately also human lives. So during the transatlantic slave trade, there was also exchanges that included human beings for beads, using, of course, ivory, gold, copper, and then precious woods or any other material, palm oil, even. Yeah, whatever might be. So it became a currency, these glass beads called ponteria. Glass beads were once a currency, but then also a trade item. So sometimes it had a real value on its own, and sometimes it was just used as more or less, a barter item. But it was indispensable in the European exploration, extension, expansion into the rest of the world to be able to offer at one point gifts, but then more than that, then to be able to exchange for commodities that one would want to bring back here.
I just was really fixated on that because I was thinking in school we learn about, you know, trade and economics and resources that countries have and the power they hold in that, you know, with Ukraine and the minerals. And to me, it was just a fascinating kind of metaphor for the geopolitical landscape across the globe.
In my practice as an artist, I often look at the past to understand what's going on now, because I think as human beings, we repeat a lot of gestures, a lot of ways of being. And I think what we might be seeing happening now in the world, what is important in terms of different items and how that can lead to asymmetric power relationships, I would say, that's not anything new. It happened in the past. It's kind of a human repetition, I'd say, like we repeat this as human beings, as societies, between societies, as saying, well, you have this, I want it. And sometimes it's an equal or amicable exchange. Sometimes it's not. And so in the Venice work, I was kind of exploring that question, but also the question of value. So what could be valuable in the eyes of one person is maybe not in the other. And that's a question, I guess, of sometimes rarity, sometimes novelty, and or being able to commodify that and make that an act of commerce. So, you know, for example, ivory at the time that it was started to be traded was so abundant in Eastern Africa, for example, that it wasn't seen as something to hold on to. You would use it for making fences, for example, to keep your cattle in or out, or livestock rather, not necessarily cattle. But of course, in Europe, it would be a very prized material to make these very refined objects. So it's really the question of, you know, the value is really in the eye of the beholder, but that allows for these exchanges, which might sometimes seem unequal, but are negotiated because it's a question of what do I want? What do I value? What is my desire to have something else? And there's a term in economics, which I came across when I was doing this work, which is the coincidence of wants. So it's kind of, or the double coincidence of wants. So to be able to trade, there has to be a desire on one side for something and an equal desire on the other side for the other thing. And in that case, when they align, then there can be trade or there can be exchange. So I like that idea also of thinking about the wants and desire, kind of this question that it is an economic or maybe a number game in some ways, but the starting point is really a question of a desire that comes from that. So it's really a deep human feeling of desiring something, and that could be, you know, many things.
So in the time that you've been here, you were able to interact with some of the local artists. I don't know, anything that you're particularly struck by with their work that you've seen, you know, compared to, you know, what you've seen over in Europe?
I think that there's some similarities with, I would say, a larger questioning or maybe a visibility or space that is being held for question of relationality. So relationship to each other, to land, looking also at cultural links and heritage mentioned an ancestry. I think that's a conversation that we're seeing more and more globally that has more space, and it's a very welcome, I think, thing to see. So I think that's maybe it was a louder, more vocal voice here than maybe I would have had elsewhere. But I would say that in Canada, where I've lived, but not really as an artist, there's also that conversation happening in other parts of the world too. So I'd say that it's part of a global conversation amongst artists where I guess different value systems again and different cultural systems that are not solely Eurocentric are having their space and are being able to be articulated in beauty and in complexity, which is very nice.
Anything you want to share with our listeners just about this concept of modern art? Because there are traditional arts and people, there are purists, but there are also people that elevate what is tradition and it becomes something else. And it's just like, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that what is wonderful about any kind of artist or creative person is that one finds their own language. And so it's when one creates work, they find a language in which to communicate with others. And so I think contemporary artists do that. And their language can be this kind of maybe influenced on the foundations of a older, more traditional maybe craft, but then it's of this time and is looking to the future or is looking at the concerns of now and in conversation with global aesthetics, global conversations. So each artist, I believe, creates their own language. And so it's, for me, it's hard to say, you know, contemporary art or contemporary artists. I think every artist has their own voice. And I think it's always interesting to see what each artist's voice is giving. And I think that a voice that is influenced maybe by the place in which they grew up in or the culture in which they are embraced in will give a different tint or timbre than another place. And I think that's the beauty of seeing that it's of the now, but it can have an echo or a kind of an influence of a place or of a culture that makes it unique, as well as the personality, of course, of the artist. So that kind of complexity of all the different elements that kind of come together as these ingredients to create a voice, to create a recipe of art making is the beauty of being in the now.
And if you wanted to say something to someone who has never been to a triennial show, what would you say to get them to come?
For those who maybe are not as familiar going to see contemporary art, I'd say it's just for you to observe, to view, and there is no right or wrong answer. There is no right or way to see things. Everyone should feel that it's a place for them to be. It's sad that sometimes people feel that maybe it's not, you have to have studied art or be in quote-unquote art circles to be able to appreciate or to understand. But art is wonderful in that way that it doesn't need to necessarily have a discourse behind it or beside it. It can just be felt immediately. And each person will feel things differently. And that's what it is, the beauty of a connection between an artwork and each individual. And they'll be totally different experiences. And that's completely wonderful, I think, about the flexibility of art.
Well, thank you so much for coming down and sharing some of your time and your thoughts with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was artist Kapuana Kiwanga, who is taking part in the Hawaii Contemporary 2025 Triennial Festival happening across the state. The internationally acclaimed artist and scholar will be featured at a free talk at the University of Hawaii tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Art Auditorium and at an event tonight at the Bishop Museum. We'll have links on our website later today. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to talk with the governor about his plan to expedite the hiring of federal workers cut by the new Republican administration as it tries to rein in federal spending. Leave us your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archived shows online by searching for The Conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.